the blue. They're not, they're just, let me guess, having a trial separation? Right. Yeah, that's the first step, said Lily, who's been through it enough times to know. She tossed her long black hair. But hey, join the club. Hardly anyone's parents are together anyway. Plus, Morrow added, just think, now your mom will be too wrapped up in herself to bug you about stuff all the time. That was it. No surprise from her friends, no advice, no sympathy. Tess wanted to cry, but instead she took her cue from Morrow and Lily, pasted a big stupid grin on her face, and acted like her parents' separation was no big deal. But it is. Even now, thinking about it, she feels miserable. So miserable that she'd rather think about Julius Caesar's tragedy than about her own. She looks back at her annotated text again. Focus. Fate versus free will. Tess writes, because Julius Caesar believed that men at some time are masters of their fates. Wait, Caesar didn't say that about fate? The quote was from Cassius, talking to Caesar's friend Brutus, right? She checks the text. Right. Tess rewrites. Caesar continuously ignored the omens of his impending death. Now what? She should give specific examples of the omens. Flipping back through the text, she comes up with a bunch. Ominous storms, lions in the streets, sacrificial animals that are dissected and turn out not to have hearts. It's pretty creepy stuff, Tess decides, writing it all down. And what about his wife's foreboding dream about his statue covered in blood? And the soothsayer who warned him to beware the Ides of March? What are the Ides of March again? Tess flips through her notes. Oh, March 15th, the day Caesar was assassinated. Which also happens to be the day Tess's father moved out. She misses him desperately. The house feels hollow without him. She feels hollow. It's funny, because even when he lived here, he wasn't around all that much. His job, something high-ranking in computer technology, which she doesn't really understand, is demanding, and he was always at the office or traveling. But his stuff was here. When you walk past someone's favorite Yankees cap hanging on a hook in the mudroom, or reach past their leftover midnight pizza in the fridge when you get milk for your morning cereal, it's kind of like they're there. Now the hook by the back door is bare, and all that's ever in the fridge is healthy crap Mom keeps trying to shove down Tess's throat. Also missing from the fridge, besides cold pizza, vodka, white wine, beer, all the booze that used to come and go almost on a daily basis. Mom drank. Now she doesn't. Big deal. The thing is, it's a big deal. Whether Tess wants it to be or not, all of it, Mom drinking, Mom not drinking, Dad moving out, the countless rules that haven't changed since then and the new ones that have been added, the silence, the boredom, the lack of freedom. God, I hate my life. Tess looks back at her notes again. Beware the Ides of March. Yeah, no kidding. She scowls and jabs the volume button on her iPod, raising it so that the hip-hop bass throbs almost painfully in her ears. She never used to like this kind of music, but lately the angry, rhythmic lyrics appealed to her. Lately, a lot of things appeal to her that never did before, which kind of scares her. Not that she'd admit it to anyone but herself. The school year's almost over, though. Yeah. And as soon as it is, Mom's going to haul her down to the beach, away from her friends, away from Dad, away from Heath Pickering. Standing in her kitchen, eyes squeezed shut, Cam can see the girl pretty clearly. Elfin features, upturned nose, straight, wispy, long blonde hair. It's hard to make out the color of her eyes, though. They're tear-filled, and she keeps squeezing them closed. She's about 13 years old, maybe 14, but small for her age. What else? She's filthy, caked in dirt, huddled on the ground. She's clutching a purple backpack and wearing what looks like a school uniform, One tail of her once white blouse hangs below her navy vest, and her legs are scraped and bloodied between her blue knee socks and short pleated plaid skirt. Blue and green plaid. Blackwatch? Is that what it's called? Around her neck, at the open collar of her blouse, is a silver chain with some kind of small, triangular black pendant hanging from it. Watching the child's narrow little body heave with silent sobs, Cam clenches her hands so hard that what's left of her methodically bitten fingernails dig painfully into her palms. Her own saliva is tainted by the metallic taste of the little girl's fear, her thoughts by the little girl's frantic introspection. Oh, please, God, don't let me die. Please. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. What if she never gets to go back home? Home? The girl's eyes squeeze tightly shut. She's picturing it, Cam realizes. Picturing her home. Yes. Show me, sweetie. Cam does her best to zero in on the image inside the girl's head. Come on. Let me see. Slowly, it takes shape. A two-story frame house, the architectural style hearkening to a child's crayon drawing. A door centered between two shuttered windows on the first floor, three more windows above on the second, and an A-line roof with a brick chimney on one side. The roof is gray-black shingles. The clapboards are white. The shutters are black. Towering maple tree sentries guard the front yard. There are hundreds of thousands of houses like it throughout the Northeast. That's where it is, Cam is certain. Somewhere here in the Northeast. Not right here in Montclair, though. Maybe not even in New Jersey. New York? Pennsylvania? Delaware? Where is the girl's house, damn it? Wait, there's something to the right of the door, beneath the brass lantern-style light fixture. It's a house number. 42. But 42 what? What's the name of the street? Where is it? Show me. Helpless, Cam can only watch the image give way to the girl herself again. She's curled in a fetal position in the shadow of a wall, rocking back and forth. The wall appears to be made of rock, the floor of dirt. She's in some kind of cellar. Cam zeroes in on the girl's face, memorizing her features, watching her bite her trembling lip, wishing she would open her eyes. Then, miraculously, she does, as if on cue. Her tear-flooded pupils, Cam sees, are a light hazel shade. Her lashes are sandy, barely visible. She'll need mascara when she grows up, Cam finds herself thinking idly. Then, if she gets to grow up. A familiar wave of hopeless, helpless panic is beginning to take hold. Here is Cam's own panic, mingling in her gut with the child's primal fear that even now remains tempered by a wisp of naive hope. But Cam knows better. Breathe. Focus, she tells herself. Focus on that girl. You can't help her if you don't focus. Look at the stone wall, the dirt floor. Look, what else is there? Where is she? Wall, floor. There are no other details. There's nothing more to go on. She's in a basement of some kind. Where? It, too, feels as though it's located someplace in the Northeast. Yes. And not far from the house with white clapboards and black shutters. More. You need more. What else? Don't just look. Smell. Musty. Damp. Listen. There's water nearby. Moving water. Cam can hear it rushing. There's some kind of current. A creek? A stream? A river? She strains for something more, and gradually she hears it. But not water. A faint rhythmic sound reaches her ears. A sickeningly familiar sound. What is it? As it grows ominously louder, she sucks in her breath, and the smell hits her. The recognizable organic smell of soil. Rich, damp soil, pungent, black, and crumbly. She begins to comprehend, and new dread sweeps through her. Oh, Lord. Lord help that child. It's a shovel. That's what she's hearing. Every dull, clanging thud seems to slam painfully into Cam herself. Somebody's digging, not far from the girl, maybe somewhere above her. Who are you? Cam demands of the person whose hands clench the wooden handle. Let me see your face, damn it. The shovel merely continues to dig, and all she can see are gloved hands. They dig, and all the while, the little girl is huddled somewhere nearby, rocking, crying, trying to catch her breath, missing her white house with the black shutters, missing her parents. Mommy? Daddy? Show them to me, Cam calls silently. I need their names, or at least to see their faces, something, some detail, some clue as to who they are, who you are. But the child is too distraught for coherent thought, her mind fraught only with frantic, fragmented images. Every breath she takes sounds increasingly strangled, as if she's struggling for air. Mom! Daddy! I need you! The terrible sound of her breathing is becoming more labored with every inhalation. Cam senses that she's running out of time. Who else, sweetie? Who else is there? Mommy, Daddy, Grandma, just give me a name. A street, a town, please. Please keep breathing. Please hang in there. Damn it. Cam would give anything to actually make herself heard this time. This time? She's felt this way every time. But of course it's never happened. In all those years, she could only helplessly observe unsettling scenes like the one now unfolding in her mind's eye. She was no more able to interfere in the action than a viewer of a movie can alter the plot. Perhaps it's human nature to try, anyway, to attempt the impossible and permeate the translucent one-way veil that separates Cam's world from this troubled stranger's. Give me a name, please. A sister, a brother, a pet, anything. Anything more specific than Mommy, Daddy. The vision is fading already. No, Cam whispers. Please, wait. But the image of the child has already dissolved. Lingering in Cam's head is an awful, shuddering gasp for air. Moments pass. Another gasp. Then a terrible, deadly silence. Tess has been in love with Heath Pickering, a senior, from the first time she saw him at the beginning of her freshman year. She noticed him immediately, passing by her every day in the hall after homeroom. He stood out from the other guys, who always wear what Tess has come to consider the public school uniform, jeans, sneakers, and a t-shirt, long-sleeved or short-sleeved, depending on the time of year. Not Heath. He wears jeans, yeah, but he wears them with boots or sandals, depending on the weather, and usually with shirts that have collars and buttons. Not dress shirts, like Dad's, but casual shirts, untucked. A few times, he's had t-shirts on, and once one of them had a familiar LBI logo on the front. LBI, Long Beach Island. Tess has a couple of those t-shirts herself. She started wearing them to school more often, hoping Heath might notice. But if he has, he hasn't said anything. Well, it's not like the two of them are the only kids at school with LBI t-shirts. Plenty of people around here head down there for the summer. Tess can only hope Heath might turn out to be one of them. She's noticed he's always got some kind of necklace on. Not a gold chain or anything like that. More like something a surfer would wear. Someone said Heath moved here not that long ago from California, so Tess finds it easy and exciting to picture him expertly riding the waves, tanned and naked from the waist up. She frequently daydreams about it. Heath's brows and lashes are darker than his hair, which is blonde and kind of shaggy. He's got big brown puppy dog eyes, kind eyes, Tess has noticed. Yeah, she can tell he's a really nice guy. The type of guy who would make a great boyfriend. She imagines that all the time, Heath coming over to her and introducing himself, saying he thinks she's really cute for a freshman. No, just that she's really cute, period. because in her fantasy, he has no clue she's a freshman. Anyway, he says he's been noticing her. Then he asks her out. Lately, she's been taking her daydreams a step further. She imagines what it would be like if she marries Heath someday. Tess Pickering. Sounds good. She likes to whisper it out loud when she's alone in her room at night. Sometimes she even writes it down, practicing her future signature. She does that now. Tess Hastings Pickering. Analyzing it, she decides, as always, that there are just too many Ings. But she'd probably get used to that. Or she could drop her maiden name, like Mom did when she married. Stop it. Don't even go there. Lately, Tess tries not to ruin rosy thoughts about her imaginary future relationship with Heath by thinking about Mom and Dad. After all, her parents first met when they were in school. College, not high school. But still, only a few years older than Tess and Heath. Well, Heath, anyway. Look what happened to Mom and Dad. But that wouldn't happen to Heath and me. Nope. When they get together, they'll stay together forever. Tess Ava Hastings Pickering. Time is running out, though. The school year is almost over. It's been months since she did some detective work and memorized Heath's schedule so she could detour into his path between classes all day long. She always tries to lock eyes with him when they pass each other in the hall, but he doesn't seem to notice her. Sometimes she thinks she should just crash into him so he can't help but notice her. Only then he might think she's just some stupid freshman klutz and not his future wife. Tess Hastings Pickering. Yeah. Maybe she'll hyphenate. Her friends aren't even going to take their husbands' names when they get married. Lily, whose mother has had four different last names in her life, thinks it's a stupid, demeaning custom. Morrow said she and her husband will just make up a new name for themselves so that it's fair to both of them. Tess thinks that if you're married to someone, you should have their name. What if you get divorced? Is Mom going to go back to being Camden Neary again? Tess hopes not. But if her parents get divorced, what her mother chooses to call herself will probably be the least of her problems. Don't think about divorce. Think about Heath, or homework, even. Julius Caesar. Heath. He plays on the school baseball team. Tess almost died the first time she saw him a few weeks ago in his uniform, those snug white pants and a cap pulled low and sexy over his eyes. She decided right then that she had to do something soon. Otherwise, school will be out, and she'll go away for the summer, and he'll find a new girlfriend. He used to have one in the city, but they reportedly broke up last fall, right before Tess discovered him. His single status can't last, though. Tess has to make her move soon, or get one of her friends to make it for her. Tess Ava Picker. Oops. The tip of her overly sharpened pencil just snapped. She shudders. To her, the scraping of the splintered wooden hollow of broken lead across paper is like fingernails on a chalkboard. She trades the pencil for a fresh one with a slightly duller point, flips to a clean page, and decides she'd really better get busy on her homework. Fate versus free will. She flips pages, rereads the passages about Caesar's death. Et tu, Brute, he uttered on his dying breath, realizing that his trusted friend was among the conspirators. Deciding Caesar was a fool for not paying more attention to the signs all along, Tess goes back to her essay. It's dark, and it's late, and it's raining. The drive from Long Beach Island took hours longer than it should have, thanks to a train derailment near Camden. A toxic one, as it turned out, which led to the road being closed and a detour through the suburbs. A wrong turn from there led to the streets of this so-called family neighborhood in East Green Branch. A wrong turn? Or fate? She's here somewhere, nearby. I can feel it. I just have to figure out where she's been hiding from me, and why. For now, it's enough just to cruise along these residential streets beneath a canopy of maple trees, passing rows of older houses, wondering which one is hers. I'll come back tomorrow, when it's light, when all the pretty young girls aren't safely tucked into bed, having sweet, naive dreams. The shark's tooth, the sign, is safely wrapped in several layers of Kleenex and stashed in the glove compartment. The rain beats down on the car roof, the radio plays soft jazz, and the windshield wipers swish rhythmically, seeming to echo the silent, soothing mantra. Find her. Find her. Part 2. June. Chapter 3. Cam throws another pair of shorts into the open suitcase on the bed she once shared with Mike, and she wonders why she even bothered. It's not as if they're likely to fit for more than another week, maybe two at the most. She desperately needs to go shopping for some summer maternity clothes. Shorts with elastic bands at the belly, sleeveless tops to reveal her fleshy upper arms, maternity bathing suits. Yeah, that'll be fun. But it was, last time around, she remembers wistfully as the warm night breeze stirs the shears at the open window. It shouldn't have been fun, shopping on a strict budget in pricey Manhattan maternity boutiques, battling nausea the whole time. But whenever she stepped out of a dressing room wearing some ill-fitting, overpriced garment over a strapped-on foam belly provided by the store, Mike would flash an emotional smile and tell her she looked great. She didn't look great, and she didn't feel great, and they couldn't afford any of it. The clothes, the medical care, the baby. But that didn't matter. Mike being there with her every step of the way made it all okay. This time around, she'll have to go it alone. Maternity clothes shopping, blood work and tests with potentially scary results, labor, diapers, the whole thing. Unless... Nope, no way. They're already into June now, and he hasn't come home. Not to stay, anyway. He comes and goes in the driveway, thanks to his regular visitations with Tess, but he never ventures into the house. If she happens to be at the door, he'll wave and call out a greeting, but that's about it. They talk on the phone a few times a week to discuss the details of his visitation schedule, household bills or repairs, that sort of thing. She hasn't even had an opportunity to mention the pregnancy to him, if she was ready. Which she's not. When she is ready, though, it's not something she should mention in passing. Tess has to be home early tomorrow night because of finals. I scheduled the annual cleaning for the hot water heater, and, oh, by the way, I'm pregnant. No. She'll have to summon him over, sit him down, drop the bombshell. Then, what? Wait for his reaction. Wait for him to get over his shock. To ask why she didn't tell him sooner, to say that he wants to be a part of this baby's life, all of which is inevitable. But where do we go from there? Do they continue on in this state of marital limbo? Trial, separation. She's tried it. She doesn't like it. She doesn't want it. But Mike, apparently, does. Otherwise, he would be reaching out to her, talking about coming home. All he'd have to do is ask, and she'd take him back. When he finds out about the pregnancy, he might decide to do just that. But she doesn't want him back that way. She wants him back because he still loves her. Because I still love him. She shoves another pair of Too Snug shorts into the suitcase. Mike will be dropping off Tess soon. It's a Tuesday night. He took her to a nice seafood restaurant for dinner to celebrate her terrific final report card. Cam stayed home, planning on eating cold cereal to take in her nightly milk serving in front of the TV. Then she decided that seemed pitiful. So she threw together a stir fry and ate it on the good china, sitting alone at the kitchen table, reading a literary novel, and trying not to wish that the raspberry-flavored seltzer in her glass was Pinot Grigio. Talk about pitiful. But still better than cold cereal and TV. All right, what now? Should I catch Mike in the driveway and tell him we need to sit down and talk before Tess and I leave for the shore Friday morning? Yes, she should. In the split second after she makes that decision, as if to reinforce it, she hears a car pulling into the driveway below. Sitting in with the band, Ike Neary spots her in the middle of the first set, during the opening riff of Brown-Eyed Girl. The shock is nearly enough to make him lose his grip on the drumsticks, but somehow he manages to hang on. Brenda? Oh my God, Brenda. After all these years. Hey, where did we go? Sings the lead vocalist, a kid named Jimmy. Ike strumming. And miraculously, Brenda's familiar face is here among the throng that's gathered to drink and dance to live music at the Sand Bucket Grill on this warm Tuesday night in June. Oh my God. What should Ike do? What will he say to her? What does one say after 30-odd years to a wife who walked away and never looked back? A wife who left you to single-handedly raise one daughter and bury the other. Swept by a familiar surge of fury-tainted grief, Ike blinks away the tears pooling in his eyes. What is she doing here? How did she know where to find me? He wasn't even officially supposed to play tonight. He never does, these days. But Jerry, the owner, spotted him and asked him if he'd sit in for a set. "Ladies and gentlemen," he said, "we have a very special guest here tonight to help us inaugurate the Sandbucket's new stage." Over the winter, Jerry built a fancy new outdoor stage out back. Now he has to pay for it and compete with the big acts in nearby Atlantic City. So he's stepping up his exposure in the Shore papers. This week, he took out ads with color photos of all the new bands playing the Sandbucket's new stage, alongside black and white photos of the legendary musicians who played there in the past. Brenda must have spotted Ike's picture among them. Maybe it triggered her memory. Right, because she got hit on the head all those years ago, came down with amnesia, and wandered away. Of all the scenarios he conjured after his wife disappeared, that's the best. It sure as hell beats the one where she gets abducted from their apartment in the crime-ridden neighborhood, murdered, and her body dumped in a landfill somewhere. And the one where she just walks away to start a new life somewhere without him and the girls. Do you remember when we used to sing? Forcing his eyes open, Ike chimes in on the familiar chorus. Sha-la-la-la-la-la-la. His eyes scan the swaying, singing crowd below, seeking Brenda. La 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 ti ta. She's gone. Again. So what do you think, Messy Tessie? Seated beside her father in the front seat of his silver-blue Saab as he pulls into the driveway, she can't help but smile at the affectionate nickname. It doesn't fit her. It never really did. But she's always liked it anyway. What do I think about what?
About the fourth.
Oh, right. He was just telling her about all the things they could do for the Independence Day holiday in a few weeks. And she was thinking about other things. Nice things for a change, like Heath Pickering. And not so nice things, like whether she should feel as guilty as she has been about letting Morrow cheat off of her in the English final the other day. The thing is, who does it really hurt? No one. Tess is great at English. Morrow, who says she really thinks she might be dyslexic, is not. Tess has been trying to help her with the Shakespeare stuff for the past month, but there's so much Morrow just isn't getting. When Morrow finally asked Tess if she could copy her answers since they sit right next to each other alphabetically, Tess had to say yes. Well, she didn't have to. But she feels sorry for Morrow because of her disability. And anyway, if Tess hadn't agreed, Morrow probably wouldn't be doing her this huge favor in return, having her new boyfriend, Chad, a junior and a friend of Heath's, talk to him about Tess. Bold move. But Tess had little choice. It was either that or leave town in a few days for the entire summer without Heath knowing she's alive. She heard he got a lifeguard job for the summer at an ocean beach. She wonders where. Remembering his LBI t-shirt, she wonders if it's somewhere down near Long Beach Island. That would totally be fate. Maybe he'll turn up right in Beach Haven itself. Wouldn't that be a dream come true? Spending a summer at the shore with Heath? That can't exactly happen unless she meets him, which is why she told Morrow to tell Chad to tell Heath about her. At Lily's pool party tomorrow, she's supposed to find out what he said. Heath might even show up there, according to Morrow, who invited, like, everyone in the school. It's not even her party, but Lily doesn't care. Her mother won't even be home. "What are my choices again?" she asks her father, reaching out to turn down the radio, which is broadcasting tonight's Yankees game. He could have been there. Someone he knows through work got last-minute box seats. Dad loves the Yankees. "But I love you more," is what he told Tess. She believes it, most days. "We can go to Cape Cod to visit the Nortons at their beach house," he begins ticking off on his fingers. "Or we can have a barbecue at Grandma and Grandpa's. Or we can watch the fireworks over the East River from my roof in the city."
"What about Long Beach Island?"
"What about it?"
"We always watch the fireworks there."
They always have, even back before they got the beach house on Dolphin Avenue. As a kid, Mom always spent her summers on the shore, mostly Long Beach Island, with Granddad, and she's nostalgic about it. She wants Tess to have that same tradition. Dad hesitates, either straining to hear the radio announcer, who's shouting about some Yankee who just got a hit and loaded the bases, or trying to figure out what to say. Tess stares out the window at the red brick, white-shuttered colonial that hasn't really felt much like home since Dad left. Yellow light spills from the black wrought-iron fixtures beside the door and along the curved path bordered by long flower beds. Normally by June, there are pastel-colored annuals planted there. Not this year. The beds have only dirt and mulch, waiting for blossoms Tess suspects will never be planted. Mom usually goes to the garden center around Mother's Day to fill the Volvo station wagon with plastic cell packs of blooming geraniums and impatience. Dad would tell her they can get the landscape service to do it, but Mom never wants that. She says she loves kneeling in the sunshine, working the earth with her trowel, making things grow. But this year, she doesn't seem to care. About a lot of things, not just the flowers. And Tess, who never paid much attention, is surprised at just how much it bothers her to see plain old dirt in the beds every time she steps into the yard. "Would you rather just spend the fourth at the shore with your mother?" Dad finally asks, interrupting her bleak thoughts. "Your mother." She hates how he's taken to saying it that way. Before the separation, he used to just refer to her as Mom. "Your mother, ugh. It's so distant. As if that's his only connection to Mom, that she's Tess's mother and not his wife."
"Do you want to spend it at the shore?"
Tess asks her father in return.
"I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about you."
Ignoring that, she repeats,
"Well, do you?"
"Do I what?"
"Want to spend the fourth at the shore?"
Dad frowns.
"With your mother?"
"Your mother."
"You know what? Never mind."
Tess snaps and opens the car door.
"But I don't know what I want to do yet. I'll figure it out later. It's still weeks away. Thanks for dinner. Night."
"Tess."
About to slam the car door, she opts to close it instead. Firmly. Then she jogs toward the front door with a backward wave. Dad just sits there for a few seconds, like he's either trying to hear what's happening with the baseball game or trying to decide if he should come after her. She wishes he would. She wishes he'd come into the house with her, close the door, and stay. But he won't, because the bases are loaded and Mom, her mother, is here. And he doesn't love her mother more than he does the Yankees. He doesn't love her mother at all. For a while there, Tess didn't blame him. But lately, Mom has seemed kind of lost, sad, vulnerable. Okay, so she obviously screwed up their marriage, but maybe she deserves a second chance. Doesn't everyone?
Yeah, including Dad.
Tess turns toward the car again, wondering if she should run back and tell him never mind about the fourth, that she'd love to spend it with him, wherever.
but he's already backing out of the driveway. Slipping back onto a stool at the long bar, Ike tilts the icy brown bottle to his lips and swigs a fresh beer. All the doors and windows are open to let in the salty night air and the live music out back. A new band has taken the stage, a couple of kids who just graduated from college and decided to launch careers as musicians. Yeah, good luck with that, Ike thinks, setting the beer on a cardboard coaster. In this day and age, it's not easy. Was it ever? Probably not. But for Ike, it sure seemed that way. He dropped out of high school to become a busboy at a supper club in Fort Lee, back when the swing orchestra and crooner scene was going strong. Pearl Bailey, Dean Martin, a kid named Frank Sinatra, who hailed from right down the Palisades in Hoboken. There were countless lesser, if not completely unknown, acts, too. It was a lesser known who taught Ike to play the drums after hours and told him he had talent. By the time he was 20, he believed it. A cocky son of a bitch. Hitched a ride down to the beach one summer night that changed his life. That was the early 50s. Doo-wop music was taking hold in Philly, spreading to the Jersey Shore. Ike was great with harmony. Classic case of right place, right time. Someone asked him to sit in on the drums, sing a little backup. He did, and a star was born. Ha, that's what he thought. Yeah, but he wasn't the only one. He had quite a following, right from the start. Easy breezy. Then he met Bren in Beach Haven. She was just a kid then, genuine jailbait. But Ike wasn't old enough, or maybe just not smart enough or strong enough, to know better. He took one look at Brenda Ann Johnson on the beach in that not-so-virginal white bikini, and he fell hard. Got her name tattooed on his right forearm a few days later, rimmed by a heart. Knocked her up in no time, and felt obligated to settle down and support a family. Sure as hell not easy to do on a rented drum set and a dream. God knows he tried, though. For her, for his precious baby, Ava, and later for Camden, who Bren always called their midlife crisis surprise. But Cam turned out to be Ike's salvation. If he didn't have Cam after he lost everything else, he'd have had nothing to live for. Then again, if he didn't have Cam, maybe he'd still have his Brenda. Cut it out. Ike guiltily steers his brain away from that particular thought process, though not as effectively as he used to. When Cam was a little girl, it was much easier for him to focus on her many needs and not on his own devastation or what might have been. For a long time, Ike was able to ignore the truth. It was the second pregnancy that did Brenda in. She went off her medication, afraid of what it might do to the baby, and she never went back on it. Not that he knew, anyway. So if Cam had never been born, he'd still have Brenda. Sometimes in his aging, irrationally resentful mind, it's that simple. Yo, Ike, what'd you think of the new digs out back? Nice, huh? Billy, one of the bartenders, asks as he materializes at this end of the bar to load a blender with ice. Nice, Ike agrees, forcing himself back to the present, away from the futile what-ifs. You guys sounded good tonight. We always sound good. Better on the new stage, though, right? Billy's bare, muscular, tattooed arms reach for some kind of blue liqueur, some berries, pineapple. He tosses it all into the plastic pitcher with the ice, then flips the switch. What the hell kind of drink are you making? Ike asks above the blender, the chatter, the wailing guitars out back. This here? It's for them, Billy indicates a couple of clean-cut guys down the bar. They're wearing pastel polo shirts, shorts, no socks. Cologne, too, Ike's willing to bet. He knows their kind. He's been seeing more and more of them around here lately, and fewer rockers, bikers, working-class types. Billy pours the fruity slush into a pair of glasses, real ones, not plastic, then plunks in a pair of straws and paper umbrellas, garnishing the whole thing with a wedge of pineapple on the rim. Cripes, Billy. A fancy stage, girl drinks. Next thing I know, you'll be wearing a tux. That ain't gonna happen. Don't be so sure. I think Jerry's trying to change the image of the place, attract a different kind of crowd, like what they tried to do up in Asbury Park.
Billy smirks and heads off down the bar with his girl drinks, leaving Ike to drink his beer and reminisce about the glory days here on the South Jersey shore. He keeps an eye on the crowd, though, still looking for Brenda, in case he really did see what he thought he saw earlier from the stage. Too late. Mike's car is disappearing down the street when Cam opens the front door. That was fast. Usually he lingers a few minutes, as though he can't bear to say goodnight to his daughter just yet. On the doorstep, Tess looks up, startled. Cam, glimpsing fleeting distress in her face, asks, "What's wrong?"
"Nothing," Tess shoots back. "What's wrong with you?"
Cam scolds. "Watch your tone, Tess." With a scowl, Tess amends.
"All I meant is, what are you doing out here?"
"I figured I'd open the door for you when I saw Daddy pulling up." Tess's expression instantly softens.
"Oh, well, thanks."
Looking as though she wants to add something, she comes into the house. Cam knows better than to press her daughter. "He was in a hurry to leave tonight, huh?" Cam asks casually as she closes the door.
"Yeah, I guess."
Tess heads immediately for the stairs. Cam slides the deadbolt and sets the alarm that had once seemed so necessary for a house this size, in the middle of nowhere, as Cam once saw it. Back when Mike moved into senior management and they first considered moving out of Manhattan, her only suburban experience was her childhood apartment in Camden. There were bars on the windows, junkies on the streets, and sirens screamed all night. Yeah, and it took her all of 5 minutes to figure out that this upscale, well-insulated neighborhood couldn't be farther from her roots, or closer to Mike's, even though Connecticut is 2 states away and not on the list of places she was willing to live. High on a ridge west of Manhattan, Montclair won them over with spectacular skyline views, historic architecture, and a manageable commute. Though historically the town boomed early last century when Manhattan's affluent built their mansions, and though it remains partially populated by celebrity types, the cultural elite, Wall Street, and media royalty, there is nonetheless a small town feel. It is, as the first realtor told Cam and Mike way back when, a great place to raise a family. So Montclair it was, with a built-in security system, because you can't be too careful anywhere. Not when you're a mother tormented by visions of real kids in real trouble. Cam looks up at her daughter heading up the stairs. "Tess, you should pack, tonight or tomorrow morning, okay?"
"Yeah."
Not very convincing.
"Don't leave it for the last minute," Cam calls,
but her daughter is already down the hall, closing the door to her room. She sighs, remembering Tess's little girl days, when she was always delightful, always delighted. When was the last time she heard Tess laugh? Really laugh. Not the staccato, sarcastic sound she frequently emits these days to express just how ridiculous she finds something, or someone, usually Cam. Well, can you blame her? She started a new school, turned 14, and her parents split up. All in a matter of months. Not exactly a glee-inducing combo. Only thing that can top that for Tess will be finding out her soon-to-be single mom is pregnant. Cam shakes her head and starts for the kitchen, thinking she needs a glass of milk. That's all you get tonight. Or ever. Cam sighs, longing for wine, for her little girl, for Mike. For the life she used to have, or perhaps for the life she never had at all. Okay, so it isn't the first time over the years that Ike's caught a glimpse of Brenda, only to have her either vanish into thin air or prove to be a figment of his imagination all along.
He's pretty sure he didn't take a hit of acid earlier when Frankie offered. Though, yeah, he remembers taking a hit or two off Jimmy's joint before they went on. But it's not like he's stoned out of his mind, blind drunk, or, despite his age, going senile. Maybe it was just wishful thinking. Brooding, he twirls the cold, wet beer bottle back and forth between his palms. For all he knows, Brenda has been dead all these years, just like Ava. Somewhere in the back of Ike's mind, beneath the weighted shroud of grief and loss, something stirs. No. More wishful thinking, and you know it. Or does he? Years ago, there was no DNA testing. Ava's body, with all recognizable features obliterated in the fall, was identified based on the contents of the wallet in her pocket. No one ever questioned it, or the fact that there wasn't a suicide note. Not even Ike. Not back then, anyway. But as the years passed, he began to wonder. Would his firstborn child, his beloved, beautiful daddy's girl, really have done that to him after all he had been through? Would Ava, after promising to be a stand-in mom to her little sister, have abandoned Cam as well? Was she that distraught over Brenda's disappearance, or her grades, or a breakup, or any of the things the police said might have caused her to kill herself? Anything's possible. And when Ike's stone sober, he's usually fairly convinced that it was her. When he's messed up, though, he believes anything's possible. Like some other girl diving to her death that day with Ava's wallet in her pocket, and Ava still being alive somewhere. Like Brenda showing up in some bar looking for him. Or on the street in Philly, or in an Atlantic City dive casino, or at his granddaughter's eighth grade graduation, or any of the other places Ike's glimpsed her, or so he thought, over the years. Brenda. As hard as it ever was to believe his wife had really chosen to walk away, it's even harder to fully accept, even now, that she's never coming back. Maybe that's why he keeps looking for her. For both of them. Bren and Ava. More and more lately. Or maybe he's seeing Brenda because she's really there. Maybe she couldn't stay away. Maybe she's been watching him and Cam and even Tess, keeping tabs on them, just waiting for the right moment to come back into their lives. Any time now, Bren, Ike silently tells her, wherever she is. Any time. Need another beer, Ike? Billy asks, and he shakes his head. The night is young. It's time to move on. Ike drains his beer and leaves the empty on the bar, then shuffles off toward the door and the neon-lit world beyond. Bases loaded, two outs, bottom of the ninth on a beautiful night here in the Bronx, the radio sportscaster is saying as, driving past the stately mansions of Montclair, Mike fights the urge to make a U-turn and go back and... what? Knock on the door and demand that Tess make a decision about where she wants to spend the 4th of July? What would that accomplish? She's not in a reasonable mood. She hasn't been in a reasonable mood since she turned 14 and he moved out. Nice timing, you selfish jerk. Cam didn't say that, but she wanted to. He could tell. He's said it to himself enough times since he made what now feels like a stupid, spontaneous decision to jump off what he'd decided was a sinking ship. The pitcher whines, kicks and deals, outside, ball one. Poor Tess. Never in a million years did Mike ever believe his own daughter would become the product of a broken home. Divorce happens to other people, not him and Cam. Or so he thought, until he woke up one day and asked himself whether he'd be happier with her or without her. The answer seemed so damn clear at the time. As far as he was concerned, they'd hit an all-time low when she refused to accompany him on the February ski trip with his side of the family, an annual Christmas gift from his parents. She claimed it was because she didn't want to take Tess out of school for a week. We've always done that, and it's no big deal. Now that she's in high school, she can't just miss all those days, Mike. She can take the work with her. They won't do that.
They're trying to discourage parents from pulling their kids out for illegal absences.
That's ridiculous. She's our kid. We can take her out of school if we want to.
And have her fall behind and maybe jeopardize her grades?
Uh-uh.
Let's just ask your parents to wait until March this year for a change, since that's when her break is.
Can't. I've got to be in Prague that week, he said.
The truth was, Mike hadn't yet scheduled that particular business trip. He just knew it was coming up. But Mike knew how the suggestion that they postpone the ski trip till Tess's March break would go over with his father. Mike Sr. wasn't thrilled with Cam's decision to enroll their daughter in a public high school. He's a big believer in private school. Back when they were living on a shoestring budget in Manhattan, he was aghast that his grandchild was attending PS 42. He even offered to pay for private tuition. But you can't just walk into a private school in Manhattan, where kids are waitlisted from the time they're born. When they moved to the suburbs, though, they got Tess right into prestigious Cortland Academy, a private day school two towns over, and Mike's salary easily covered tuition. Cam never liked the private school crowd, though, especially as Tess got older. She wanted her daughter to hang around with normal kids, as she put it, as opposed to worldly rich kids. Anyway, the local public high school has a terrific reputation. Even wealthy families send their kids there. It doesn't matter how many times Mike has defended to his parents the decision, a joint one between him and Cam, to switch Tess from private school to public freshman year. Dad still doesn't get it, and he still blames Cam for a lot of things.
Here's the pitch.
Looking back, Mike wonders if things might be different now if he'd decided to forego the annual skiing trip over President's Day. Instead, for Valentine's Day, he gave Cam the biggest box of Godiva chocolate he could find, and Tess a camera that cost a small fortune. Then he broke the news that he was going away without them. Tess cried. Cam retreated emotionally. Surprise, surprise. He tried not to care. Flying solo out to Utah to meet his parents and his older brothers, Dave, who lives in Chicago, and Jeff in Los Angeles. They all seemed so content with their lives. Dad, newly retired, and Mom, a doting wife and grandmother, and Dave and Jeff with their wholesome wives, large families, big plans, bright futures. It made Mike's life back home in Jersey seem all the more isolating.
Cut on and missed.
A few weeks after he got back, he told Cam he was leaving. One look at her face when he broke the news, and he wanted to take it back. But he forced himself to hold his ground, forced himself to remember the advice his father had given him one day on the slopes. Ask yourself where you'll be in 10 years, son, if you two stay together. Do you expect things to get better or worse? Looking into the future on that blustery day, Mike envisioned himself and Cam, middle-aged and living in a household without Tess, who by then would be out of college. What would they even have to talk about? They could barely keep a conversation going now, even with Tess between them to share the burden. Mike pictured himself and Cam coasting into their retirement years, sitting at the dinner table alone together, night after night, forks clinking against china, the only other sound in the room. That, and the ice cubes dropping into Cam's glass as she refilled it yet again.
And the count is 1-1. He's 2-for-4 tonight with a double and an RBI.
Mike hasn't been able to shake the image of Cam, 10 years older, 10 years lonelier, angrier, with the drawn, angular face and bloodshot eyes of a longtime drinker, like her father. He doesn't want himself and Cam to become those people, workaholic, alcoholic. Maybe apart, they'll have a chance to escape that fate. Together, it seems inevitable. At least, that's what he managed to convince himself after talking to his father back in February. Tess told him that, within days of his leaving, Cam threw away every bottle of liquor in the house. She's supposedly gone cold turkey on the booze, which may prove that Mike was right to leave, and that his father really does, as he always claims, know best.
Here's the pitch, fastball, in there for strike 2. Yet Dad never was crazy about Cam. Conservative and old-fashioned, he had judged her before he even met her. He took issue with her past, even with her parents' lives. He hated that Cam's father is a musician, that her mother has long been out of the picture. "What kind of woman just up and leaves her husband and children?" he demanded of Mike, back when he first found out about Brendan Erie. "The kind of woman whose daughter might grow up to do the same thing." That's what Dad was thinking, even if he didn't say it out loud. Maybe somewhere deep inside, Mike was always afraid of that, too. Hell, maybe it had actually happened. Only Cam didn't check out physically, as her mother had. She checked out emotionally, putting up walls he couldn't get past. Why would she do that if she still loves him, as she claims? All these years, Mike wondered and worried. But he long ago gave up asking his wife if everything is okay. He's known for quite some time that it isn't.
Two out, the count 1 and 2 in the bottom of the 9th here at Yankee Stadium. The base is loaded with Yankees who still trail by 2 runs.
Mike gave up too, on believing that the girl he fell in love with still exists somewhere behind the mask of a burdened, bitter housewife. Still, you never know. "God, I miss you," he says aloud.
"It is high, it is far, it is gone! A game-winning walk-off grand slam, and the Yankees win! The Yankees win!"
Wait a minute. The Yankees won? Somehow Mike missed it, and he was right here all along. Yeah, that's kind of how he feels about his marriage. Shaking his head, he drives on toward the Holland Tunnel and the small rented apartment that doesn't feel like home. Then again, neither does the big brick colonial in Montclair. Jesus, Cam, what happened to us? No, that's not exactly it. More like, what have I done to us? Can I undo it before it's too late? Do I even want to? Eddie Casalino grew up in Atlantic City. He knows the beach, the boardwalk, and most of the casinos inside and out. Not that he gambles. What a waste of hard-earned cash. At 22, he's got better plans for his money. Big plans. For a year now, he's been saving every spare dollar from his day job at Packages Plus and his night job as a desk clerk at Bally's. A few more months, and he'll have enough for a bike. Not just any bike, a Harley. Used, but in great condition. Then he'll be able to move to a better apartment, someplace off the public transportation route. Yeah, by fall he'll be riding his bike back and forth to work, living someplace with decent plumbing, maybe even a yard or a balcony. Who knows? Maybe a view of the ocean. Dream big. That's what his mother always told him. Last week he went to Kaminsky, his boss at Packages Plus, to ask for a raise.
"You need to step it up a little, Eddie. Talk to the customers. Don't just hand them their mail, weigh their packages, take their money. Be friendly. If I see more initiative from you, I'll think about a raise."
He's been remembering to do what Kaminsky said. He's stepped it up at Bally's, too, making small talk with guests as they check in and out. He's never been much of a chatterbox, so it doesn't come naturally to ask people where they're from, if they've ever been to Atlantic City before, whatever. He tries to act interested in their answers, but he really doesn't give a shit.
"Night, Eddie,"
calls Angela, one of the blackjack dealers, as she passes him on his way to Pacific Avenue.
"Morning, Angela,"
he returns, as usual, and they smile before continuing on in opposite directions. She's about to clock in. He's about to take the jitney to his rented room and catch a few hours' sleep before he has to be back behind the counter at Packages Plus. Sometimes, he imagines asking Angela, who he's heard through the grapevine is divorced with a couple of kids, if she wants to go out with him. But a hot older woman like her wouldn't want to ride the bus to TGI Fridays and the multiplex. It'll have to wait until fall. As he walks along the deserted street toward the bus stop, Eddie smiles at the thought of Angela on the back of his new bike, her arms and legs wrapped around him.
Dream big.
Yep. All he needs is,
"Dude,"
he blurts involuntarily as a figure abruptly steps out of the shadows in front of him. Startled, Eddie stops short. He has no choice. The person is standing squarely on the sidewalk, facing him, blocking his way.
What?
Then he sees the gun. In the split second before it goes off, he looks up. In shocked recognition of the shooter's face, his voice clogged with dread, he begins to ask,
"Why?"
Then a flash of blinding pain, and everything shatters. His bewilderment, his big dreams, his skull. Lying on the sidewalk with his brain spattered around him, Eddie Casalino dies. The lone witness is his black-clad killer, who whispers, "Sorry, dude," before tucking away the gun and disappearing into the night. Chapter 4. Wednesday afternoon, Cam lugs yet another packed duffel bag to the heap she's been accumulating beside the back door, ready for Friday's departure. Tess is upstairs in her room, filling a few more. They're going to have a heavy load this year, even without Mike's stuff. Cam is still undecided about whether to bring the bag she filled with the marble notebooks, all the notes she'd taken over the years about missing children. She'd been thinking she might have time to go through them down at the beach, when Tess leaves to spend time with Mike. Go through them? Why? For old time's sake? To dwell on just how helpless you really were, and still are? Maybe she'll return them to the attic. The car is going to be jammed full anyway. The phone rings as Cam returns to the kitchen, and she waits for Tess to grab it on the first ring, as usual. When she doesn't, Cam goes over to check the caller ID window. The number is unavailable. Maybe it's a telemarketer. She could just let it ring. Then again, maybe it's her father. Pop still keeps an apartment over in Hoboken, but he frequently crashes elsewhere, occasionally even here with them, if he feels like it. "Can't he at least call and let us know when he's coming?" Mike used to ask early in their marriage. Cam passed that request along to her father, who tried to honor it, for a while. Eventually, Ike got back to his old ways, popping up on a whim every now and then. Tess is always thrilled to see him, and it doesn't bother Cam. In fact, she's always secretly relieved to see that her father is alive and well. She always scolds him to call more often to check in. It's not as if she can get a hold of him whenever she feels like it, even now that she got him a cell phone. Half the time he forgets to charge it or doesn't carry it with him, and he rarely bothers to check his voicemail. But that's Pop, a free spirit, and God bless him for that. They could all, Cam and Tess and Mike, use a little more of her father's easygoing attitude in their lives. Anyway, this could be Pop, calling from some bar down the shore. It wouldn't be the first time, and those calls sometimes come up on the ID as unavailable. Cam picks up the phone, hoping to hear her father's voice, almost expecting it, really. She has a feeling she's going to hear from him. "Cam? It's Kathy," her AA sponsor. So much for psychic ability that doesn't involve missing children, she thinks darkly. "Kathy," she says aloud. "What's up?" "I haven't heard from you in a couple of days, and you didn't make it to the meeting last night or the night before, so I wanted to check in." "I'm doing great." White lie, or maybe not so white. Then again, for Kathy's purposes, she is doing great, meaning she's almost 3 months sober. 90 and 90, Cam. That's the goal. I know. 90 AA meetings in 90 days. The AA mantra. One of many, actually. Cam hates that she has to be accountable to a stranger whose last name she doesn't even know, even if Kathy is responsible for getting her into recovery in the first place. Her own personal AA recruiter, really. "I owe her," Cam thinks to herself. Aloud, she explains, "I was planning to come yesterday, but I had a doctor's appointment I couldn't miss." "Anything serious?" "No, just a regular checkup." "With my obstetrician, because I'm pregnant." It's probably time she mentioned that to Kathy.
After all, the pregnancy was the initial motivating factor in her newfound sobriety, and remains the ongoing reason Cam won't be slipping, with or without 90 in 90. But it doesn't seem right to confide in someone else before she tells Mike. Granted, Kathy knows far more details of Cam's life these days than Mike does, but the pregnancy involves him directly. He should know before anyone else, and soon. And you would have made arrangements last night if he hadn't blown out of here so fast when he dropped off Tess, she reminds herself, heading into the kitchen. Kathy makes weather small talk in her ear as Cam pours oil and vinegar into a cruet for the big salad she's planning to make later, to use up the rest of the stuff in the crisper. Maybe she should just put aside her reservations and call Mike. She can probably reach him at the office right now. Or she could always call his apartment and leave a message on the voicemail there, so she won't have to talk to him directly. But how would she phrase the message exactly? And what if he doesn't call her back until it's too late and she's already left for Long Beach Island? Oh, please, how old are you? 14? Analyzing every possible scenario before calling a boy? So can we still have lunch tomorrow? Kathy is asking, and Cam belatedly remembers that tentative plan for Thursday. It was Kathy's idea. She wanted to talk about maintaining sobriety on vacation, attending AA meetings down in Beach Haven. 90 meetings in 90 days. That's the goal. Which you've already blown, and by the time you get to the shore, it'll have been